My name is Gert and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I also am about to be 67. This is to keep you from later counting on your fingers. As I stand up here, I watch people in all the places where I speak, trying to be statistical about the whole thing and thinking, now let's see, how old is this old gal? So it seems to me that it'll save time and a lot of arithmetic for me to tell you. I will be 67 the 1st of February, and if you think I'm dead, you're nuts. I'm glad to be here. I'm grateful that you're here. I think we're the greatest group on the face of all God's earth, and I mean this with all my heart. And I almost feel sorry for those of you who are non-alcoholics here. This pitch is going to be directed primarily to the alcoholics. That's where my heart is. Any of the pearls of wisdom that you can pick up, you non-alcoholics, it'll be all to your good. I speak a great deal in churches. I speak quite often in colleges. I speak to women's clubs, God help me. And wherever I speak that is not an AA group, I always miss the wonder of what you people as an audience do to any speaker. You make us better than we know how to be. You want us to be funny, and so you give us a hand on the flimsiest jokes. You're wonderful, wonderful people, and I thank God I'm one of you. I'm also a straight down the line old AA-er. My pitch is what I used to be like, what happened, and what I am like now. It is to me ridiculous to do it any other way. It is to the greater glory of God operating through Alcoholics Anonymous that I should tell you what I used to be like. We've got to know that when God performs miracles, what he's got to work with. And I tell you, in my place, he had damn little to start with. In order to tell you what I used to be like, I have to talk about money. I find that the discussion of money often embarrasses people. I also find quite consistently, however, that the people whom it embarrasses are the people who have money. Money, of course, is a commodity. It's exactly like bricks. You can use a brick to slug somebody to death with, or you can build a shrine out of it. It's what you do with it. Money may not be the root of all evil, but as far as I'm concerned, in my own experience, if it isn't the root, it's a close second. How much sooner I might have bumped into God, I cannot imagine, had I not been so upholstered from the consequences of what I did by being able to bribe my way out of it. We're all snobs at heart. We're all impressed with money. We're all impressed with social position. And when it is used so that people will accept your unacceptable behavior, then, of course, you have no consequences. You cannot learn that you cannot do this because everybody lets you do it. I was the only child of very rich parents brought up in the old Waldorf Astoria in New York, a nice, cozy background for a child. My father was a very brilliant man who came over in the steerage from Scotland when he was 9 years old and never went to school a day in his life afterwards. When he died at the age of 72, he was the best informed human being I have ever met. My mother was a raving, tearing beauty. I must have been, you laughed too soon. I must have been 8 years old when I realized that I would never have my father's brains and I would never have my mother's beauty. Now, that's the place to laugh. This was a devastating experience for a young child. I would go places with my mother and people would do a double take, and then they would say, well, she's nice and wholesome anyway. Well, now I've got news for you. Any of you who have young daughters or young granddaughters, Never apply the word wholesome to them. This is a dirty word. All females want to be slinky and devastating and femme fatale. Nobody wants to be wholesome. How much this later contributed to my alcoholism, I don't know, but I'm perfectly certain it had something to do with it. For a young child to realize that she is cramped between parents whose attractions and qualities are so superior to hers is already tilling the soil for the seeds of escapism in any form, whether it's alcoholism, which after all is just one bus that we take to run away from reality, from our ugly selves in this ugly world. When I was 9, my father, whose marriage was already rocky, decided that he would take me away from my mother, who was frivolous and beautiful and gay, and who was concerned with my making a debut later and having beaus, and there could be a much worse death. My father decided that his daughter should not marry, but should have 2 or 3 degrees, should go perhaps to, after college here, to the Sorbonne in France and then Heidelberg in Germany, and perhaps be the first woman ambassador to Great Britain. We still haven't had one. And then in her spare time, she could find a cure for cancer. Well, I just knew that none of this was going to happen. I was defeated before I ever started. I knew perfectly well that I was not going to measure up. And so already a sense of inadequacy and failure began to form within me. At 9, I went to Europe school alone. This was supposed to make me independent. When I came to write a book about all this, I decided that I'd better orient myself with this little girl. And so I looked up some, you may be sure, very faded photographs. And here's this fat-legged, hair-braided little girl standing with clenched jaw on a ship ready to go to Europe alone. You never saw anybody look less independent. I was over there until just before World War I, and then I came back and went to Smith College. Smith College is not co-educational. It was the first place I'd ever been where my father couldn't go with me. I there saw girls who could pick out what clothes they wanted to wear, how they wanted their hair cut, and you see what happens when you go too far. And they also had beaus. I had never learned any small talk. I'd never had a beau in my life. Marriage was for the birds. And this was very heady business. I would watch these girls bat their eyelashes and say to some young male, "Oh, you're so wonderful." And the male would swoon. Had I known that I had a soul, I would have been charmed to have sold it for the ability to bat my eyelashes and make some male swoon. But since Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts is very strategically located, surrounded by male colleges, you can hardly miss, and I didn't. In my junior year, a young man silly enough to ask me to marry him the first night he met me. We were in a dark room when he asked me, and so instead of saying yes, I said when. I was afraid that when he'd get the gabby out in the light, he'd see how wholesome I was. Well, a marriage based on a desire to get away from your father's demands on you, and B, the fact that you don't think anybody else will ever ask you, doesn't have a very solid basis. I had no conception that marriage was a sacrament. There wasn't any way that I would have found this out. There was no God in my family whatsoever. They could not have been more moral, more responsible, more ethical people. But no God. No God and no church. And of course, we all know that that isn't necessarily synonymous. Church membership with belief in God. There, of course, was no prayer and no Bible. I had never seen a Bible. I had seen the famous Gutenberg Bible under glass in a case in Europe in a museum. I had seen all of the early illumined monastery parchments, but I had never seen a Bible, and I had never met anyone who had a Bible. Everyone I knew was very well behaved, high economic and social level, but no church and no Bible. So I had no way of knowing that marriage was a sacrament. The marriage should have failed based on the grounds on which it was based, and it did. Out of this first marriage, however, I did get a son. He graduated from Andover and Amherst College, and 6 years ago, this coming January, if he makes it, will have graduated from 10 years on Skid Row, a confirmed alcoholic. Bill would appear at my house on the Mojave Desert in California. Once he appeared with his wrist slashed, just beginning to scab over, standing in the only pair of pants and the only shirt he owned in the world, both of them stiff with blood. The next day he disappeared, and I did not know for 3 years whether he was alive or dead. Bill has not found God, and so we know how precarious is his sobriety. He has not found it through the deeply spiritual program of AA, or through a church or a minister or any individual. When you subtract anything as all engrossing, as all time in including, as alcoholism, nature does abhor a vacuum, and when you do not put something so tremendous, so worth keeping sober for, in its place, your sobriety hangs by a thread. And so I ask you, as I ask all other audiences where I speak, to pray for Bill. He will have been sober if he makes it till January 11th, 6 years. Now, I am quite certain that the only reason that he has been sober this length of time is prayer. We have no idea what prayer is, merely that it is. Another one of these strange and amazing and indefinable mysteries. The great mass power of prayer. So you and others have kept this young man sober. When you think of it, send prayers labeled Bill toward San Francisco. You can imagine, I had not finished college. I had not gotten one degree. I had done the one thing that my father did not want me to do, to go off and marry, and that too had failed. You can imagine what the up till then incipient sense of guilt now became. I realized that I had not only failed my father, I had failed my first husband and my little boy. I had a deep sense of shame. Because of all this money, after the first divorce, it was nonsense to look around for a job. Anyway, I didn't know how to do anything. And so I looked around for husband number two. By now, I had learned how to do quite a bit more than bat my eyelashes. I am always so pleased to get snickers when I say this in front of AA, because when I say it in churches, they've never heard of sex. I went back to New York City, which was my home, and I had quite a line forming. The very fact that I would not go to bed with them made them, I'm sure, ask me to marry them. They were so astounded that they said, "All right, then marry me." So from this line, which formed, I picked out one, and the only prime prerequisite was that he be as unlike husband number one as possible. Husband number one had been very dashing, therefore husband number two must be a nice, quiet harbor, Well, friends, I got one. I didn't know how quiet a harbor could be. This was a very good man, very honorable man, very rich man, more money than anybody, and the biggest bore you can imagine. We were married for 14 years, and I couldn't remember anything that he ever said. And so when I came to write the late Liz, anything that husband number two has said is what I think he might have said. You know, I have come to believe that to bore people is a sin. It is some kind of a sin. It means that you are only concerned with yourself. Now, when I stand up here and look at you, I know whether you're bored or not. And if you're bored, it's my fault. I have obviously set myself up as somebody who's got something to say, or what am I doing here? And so if you're bored, it's due to me. Well, people who bore people don't seem to think of that. They don't know when the freeze is on. They do not see this something that goes down over people's faces. They are insensitive. They are unaware. When I first wrote my book, I made myself the only wicked person that anybody had ever known. I bore the sins of my father, the sins of my three husbands, the sins of my two sons. I couldn't have my second husband be a bore because he was such a good man. Well, he was a bore. He just was a bore. He would come home every night and sit behind the Wall Street Journal. Well, you know, this is a bore. It was along in this boring marriage somewhere that I became an alcoholic. Now, those of you who are not alcoholics here tonight, I pray that you do not permit yourself to feel superior to alcoholics. Because then you have committed the greatest sin there is, the sin of self-righteousness. There is no bum like a self-righteous bum. In the last 13 years, I have studied the New Testament from the beginning to the end, and the man by the name of Jesus Christ forgave all the whores and all the bums. He said, look, kids, cut it out. And the Pharisees, the self-righteous ones, the holier-than-thou, the self-satisfied, the smug, the pull their skirts aside and be better than, never forgave them. Let them have it. There is no diatribe in any language like that generation of vipers speech. Oh, boy, did he let him have it. So if by any chance you feel smug and feel that in some way we alcoholics do not quite measure up to you, skip it. Put your sin in the place of ours and we'll take it from there because you've got a dilly. I'm sure that you alcoholics will be glad to know that when I am speaking from pulpits in cathedrals, I say exactly the same thing. I'm just a little bit tougher. None of us know, and it doesn't make a particle of difference, when we cross the line from social drinking to compulsive drinking. I had had wine with my meals in Europe as a child continuously. I had been a social drinker. No problem. I could take it or leave it, and then suddenly I could only take it. I have no idea when this happened. I'm sure that it is connected with increasing shame in my particular case. I had no sooner gotten into this second marriage than I realized that this, too, was not it. I did not know what it was. I was amazed when I found God to find that it had a capital I. I simply knew that this, too, was not it. The shame mounted, the guilt mounted. We alcoholics are very sensitive people. We are also very humble people. We think that if some great sin has been committed in interrelationships, that we are the stinkers. Often both sides stink. I was perfectly certain that I had failed my father. Actually, he brought me up very badly. I was to do all the things that he had never been able to do. Now that he had the money to pay for it, I was to be his proxy. I was to live out the dreams that he had dreamt for himself. This is wrong. I had failed my first husband. I thought, well, my first husband failed me too. But it was years and only under God's forgiveness that I was able to see this. I was quite sure that my second husband was a saint and I was a bum. As I look back on it, he's no saint. Good, but oh, good people can be awful. Really awful. So somewhere along in this second marriage, my awareness of another failure, I think, was the primary cause for my running away on this bus labeled liquor. Somewhere along the line, I also started taking barbiturates with it. Well, this is murder. I would take benzodrine to get me up, liquor to keep me up, and sleeping pills to knock me out. Well, that makes a very small world. As I look back on those years, it was as though I had a giant iron band around me. This was my world, and I was the only thing in it. As I looked down, I could see things clearly. But as I looked up, everything was blurred, myopic. Of course, there comes a time when you have to blame somebody. If you blame yourself, then you have to change. If you can alibi yourself with other people, then you can go on for a period at least. So gradually the self-pity came. And I started blaming my father, my two husbands, and if I'd known there was a God, of course I would have blamed him too. And I got so I sat for hours at a time with the tears streaming down my face. Poor me, poor me. This woman who had had a good, strong Scotch body given her, an IQ which turned out to be the same as Einstein's. I don't know where the hell it is. I've never used it. But that's what they say. Who had had all the material goods, would have had every opportunity in the world sitting weeping for me. I got a son out of this marriage, too, who is now an Episcopal clergyman. I suppose the opposites, these two sons, more or less epitomize the extremes in their mother. When I was a pagan, I was a whole hog pagan. And now that I'm a Christian, you've got to believe I'm a whole hog Christian. And these two extremes, I suppose, are like the two extremes in their mother. I left this good man after 14 years of marriage and married another man 4 months later for the sole reason that somebody told me I couldn't get him. Well, you can see now what's happened to this woman. She's using human souls to feed her own ego. I'm sure you all will be pleased to know that this husband and I deserved each other. Oh boy, this is really a shambles. Of course, by now, to yell divorce had become the panacea for everything. With whomever I was, I would be better off with somebody else. Wherever I was, I would be better off in some other place. A real dyed-in-the-wool escapist, geographically, personally, as well as alcoholically. And so I started yelling divorce along in this third marriage. My third husband was from the wrong side of the tracks. He did not know that with the very rich and the socially elect, you let them get away with anything they want to get away with. He was not kosher. When I had yelled divorce with my first two husbands, they had said, "What will we do without you?" This one finally said, get going. He's the one human being that I never fail to thank God for every night of my life. This was the one person who finally was unwilling to accept unacceptable behavior. Of course, I couldn't take it. The very thought of admitting publicly in a divorce court 3 times that I had failed was too much for me. I had never been able to take anything else, and so, of course, I couldn't take this, and I tried to commit suicide. I took 45 grains of Tecanol on an empty stomach, cold sober. When I came to write my book, I had a doctor check it for medical details, and he said, Gert, if you say you took 45 grains of Tecanol, that's what you took. But do not put it in your book because you'll have letters from doctors and nurses all over the country. So in my book, I have it 13 grains of Tecanol because 13 is sort of a lucky number for me. I had soloed, gotten my pilot's license on a Friday the 13th after sundown in the middle of a snowstorm. And the second takeoff, the front left side of the plane came off. As you alcoholics know, whatever there is to do that's tough, we'll do it that way. So that is why I used the number 13, but it was 45 grains, and I did not throw it up, and when they found me, it was too late for a stomach pump. I am not meaning to infer for one moment that God stopped the cosmic machinery so that one old woman named Gertha Hanna could stand up here in the Austin Hotel and pitch for you tonight. But I do know that I should have been dead, and as I started off with, if you think I am, you're nuts. Now, I'm against suicide. Years ago, Cal Coolidge went to church one Sunday without Mrs. Coolidge, and when he came back, she said to him, what was the sermon about? And he said, adultery. And she said, what did the minister have to say about it? And Cal said, he's against it. So I'm against suicide. Don't any of you leave here tonight and say Gertha Hanna is in favor of suicide. But if you really want to make it, I hope you do. There is nothing more embarrassing. There really isn't. I don't know. I didn't. Most of us alcoholics, all of us, as far as I know, are hams. We even ham up death. I have some friends who quite regularly turn the gas on and call me up, and I go and turn it off. Last September, before I left the desert, a young man, half black, called me up and said he was going to take his life, and I said, are you now? Well, how are you going to do it? And he said, I've got a knife. And I said, well, I hope it's good and sharp. And he said, God damn you, and hung up. Of course, you can't count on that. If you go to turn off the gas, you might have a flat tire or something, and the so-and-so might make it. I, oddly enough, did not ham mine up. I was cold sober. I didn't write any dramatic notes. I didn't get out my best French chiffon nightgown. I just didn't have any reason to live. My father was dead and long since disgusted with me anyway. I knew of nobody whom I thought was any smarter than I was, whose advice I would take. I knew no God, nor anybody who knew him. I was a total failure. I loathed and despised myself. Every bit of me, everything I'd ever done, I hated. And I knew no way out. There was no answer. Life was intolerable, and I in it was intolerable, and so exit. Well, to come to and find you can't even die, this is embarrassing. There you are with your face hanging out. With a marriage already on the rocks, you have to go back and pretend it didn't happen. I reached home 4 days after I had tried this. And that night, the telephone rang at midnight to say that my mother had died in California. Well, the very rich are a pain in the neck, if not lower. They have something called sportsmanship. The British call it cricket.
As I look back
from that woman, I could throw up. I rose from my self-inflicted bed of pain and went out with such gallantry as you cannot imagine to inherit more money. I was there for several months, the settlement of the estate, and it was in the spring of 1947 that I returned to the Chicago area where I was then living, and by now my thinking had really taken care of my body. I was walking with a cane, crippled with arthritis. My spine was so packed with calcium that the doctors said that within 5 years I wouldn't be able to move my head. I had a blood count of 38, which is pernicious anemia. And I also had a spastic colon, which is no more romantic than it sounds. I was a complete mess, inside and outside. I went to a small and, you may be sure, very expensive sanitarium. I was there for 2 weeks, and they took pictures of things going down and things coming up. And at the end of these 2 weeks, the doctor in charge of my case had all the reports in. And he said, "Miss Bahana, you're a very sick woman, and there's nothing the matter with you." Well, the word psychosomatic had just come into common use, and I was very pleased that I knew how to use it. And I said, "You mean this is all psychosomatically induced?" And he said, "That's right." He then, however, tapped his forehead and said, "Make no mistake, though, you are a borderline case." Well, I don't suppose the idea of going insane is really very funny to the victim. He then pushed a piece of paper across the table on which there were two names written, and he said, "These are the names of two Chicago psychiatrists, and we advise that you see one of them at once." I then did a very strange thing. I pushed my chair back and I said, "I do not need a psychiatrist. What I need is God." The doctor looked at me and he said, "Well, he wouldn't hurt a damn bit." Of course, I did nothing about it, but this is very strange. What part of my unconscious this was dredged up from, I cannot imagine. I do know, however, that it was the first time in my life that I had ever used the word God seriously. The doctor then suggested that I go away for a while. Well, of course, I'd spent my whole life going away for a while. And so I got in my Lincoln Continental convertible and went to New York City, my former home, and I was drunk for 6 weeks. I wept on everybody's shoulder and told them what heels my husband's were, and how, if they just let me run the world, a much better place it would be. Well, obviously, when I say I was drunk for 6 weeks, I don't mean that I was the kind of a drunk to put lipstick on my nose. I was always on my feet and in there pitching. There would be 48 hours at a stretch, however, when I had a complete blackout. I had no remembrance of whom I was with, where I was, or what I had done. At the end of this period, I went to New Canaan, Connecticut. None of my friends were drunks. They all drank, but I was the only drunk. This was true of my hostess in New Canaan. I had been there a while, and finally she said, "Gert, before you return west, there's a couple I'd like to have you meet." Well, in AA we talk about, I was a silent drinker, I was a bar hopper, I was a bourbon man myself, and I was a wino. I was all kinds. As far as I can look, I didn't specialize. I drank anything everywhere. I would drink straight gin and sometimes alcohol in my own upstairs sitting room. I would drink in bars with everybody. Usually the people I didn't come with were much more attractive than the one I came with. I ended up as a wino because you can't get drunk on wine. Thanks. I would take with me a quart of Bristol cream to a cocktail party because I could lie to myself that if I were a real drunk, I'd be drinking bourbon. But I would drink the quart while everybody else was having three cocktails. And so, of course, I'd pass out and wonder how I could do it on wine. Having picked up all the people that I had picked up in the 6 weeks in New York, most of whom I prayed I'd never see again, I didn't want to meet any more people. And I said, why do you want me to meet these two? Because their lives have been rather like yours, and then a short while ago something happened to change their lives. I said, what happened? She was a little embarrassed, and she said they were converted. I said, to what? And she was quite embarrassed, and she said, to God. Well, then I was embarrassed. I had never known anybody who'd been converted to God. Once, when I had been in Oklahoma visiting an aunt of mine, I had been riding horseback, and I rode by a holy roller's tent. And they were rolling. And I heard all these cries coming out of there, and that's what I associated with being converted. The Sawdust Trail and the people who put Jesus Saves on their license plates. Of course, now I'm all for this. If that is their level of understanding and loving Christ, God, I'm all for this. But of course, before I knew God, I could condemn them for it. So I thought that that was what these people were going to be like. Then I remembered that my hostess didn't eat peas with her knife, so probably these people wouldn't be too bad. So I said, let them come, I'll meet them. In order to prepare myself, however, for my first two Christians, I got SWAT. I looked around for the biggest martini shaker, and it was anywhere that big. And I filled it with martinis 5 to 1. I got loaded. Well, you know, there's got to be something the matter with Christians if sinners have to get drunk to meet him. As I read the New Testament, Jesus Christ said he came to save sinners. I don't find anybody who was a bum running away from him. So now that I call myself a Christian, I have graduated to the Christian sins. I am no longer a fall-down drunk. I no longer do plenty of extracurricular sins of the flesh that I did. But I have graduated to the hair-splitting sins. I now wonder if I'm proud of not being proud. The other day, I realized that I am a snob about snobs. I am not allowed to hate people anymore. I have to love them, but I damn well don't have to like them. And so now that I am a Christian, I wonder what is wrong with us that sinners have to get swacked to meet us. Of course, when these two people appeared, I didn't need to have gotten drunk, but I already was. They were charming and delightful, easy to be with. They ate their dinner, and I drank mine. And all evening long, I bombarded them with questions about God. Oh, so they'd met God, had they? Well, well. And did God talk to them? And what did he say? And above all, could they prove him on paper? Well, that just served me right, of course, because I get that all the time now. People are always saying to me, yes, you know, the intellectual ones. They're always saying to me, yes, yes, but you can't prove God on paper. Well, don't get suckered in by that. You bet your life you can't prove God on paper. You cannot prove personality on paper. You cannot prove beauty on paper. You can illustrate it, but you can't prove it. You cannot prove compassion on paper. You cannot prove why you love one woman, you love one man. You cannot prove the thing we have in Alcoholics Anonymous on paper. You can't even prove a mathematical problem on paper because it starts with the unknown X, which you cannot prove on paper. These people didn't try to prove God on paper. They listened to me kindly, a lot of amusement, I'm sure. And finally the man said, Gert, you do have a lot of troubles. Why don't you just turn them over to God? It stopped me for a minute. What stopped me, I think, was the fact that he really meant it. Here sat this New Yorker with money and sophistication, actually sitting there believing that there was someone to whom I could turn over my troubles and who would take them. I looked at him and finally I said, you know, you make it sound as though I had luggage that was too heavy for me to carry and I needed a red cap. He said, that's about it. Well, you see how blessed I was. If he had reared back and said, well, no, we hardly want to confuse God with a porter. Or if he quoted Leviticus, I still don't know who Leviticus is. These Bible quoters. You know, Christians, Alcoholics Anonymous, we all do this. We get very shirty. When we are trying to carry the message, for the love of God, and I mean this reverently, let us carry the message on the level of understanding of the person to whom we're carrying the message. I hear these bleeding deacons in AA, these people who wander around, you know, and talk about all the, you know, make amends wherever possible, to somebody who's got the shakes so that he can't hold his own molars in. If this man had not let me have God on the level of a red cap, I would either have been dead or behind bars making noise. I looked at him and this shut me up. My first miracle, I guess. I had nothing to say from then on, and the next day I started back to Illinois and this phrase went with me. Why don't you turn your troubles over to God? Didn't mean a thing. But it did stay with me. Bill Behan and I owned a large, lovely glass house in the middle of 96 acres of virgin timber. There was a driveway a mile long leading down to the house with giant elms on either side which met overhead in God's great green bower. I didn't know that then. Usually when I'd been away, which was right often, and would come back and start down this driveway, my throat would close, another psychosomatic ailment. Often it would close so that I couldn't swallow my own saliva and would hold a wad of Kleenex to catch it. This time my throat didn't close. I didn't think of it, but the next day I remembered. I went into the house, it was a 6 weeks accumulation of mail, and I went through the first class mail. Found a short note from this couple in New Canaan welcoming me home. I could not imagine why they cared. Why would they care about me? They had only seen me once and I had been a total mess. Why did they care? They went on to say that every morning at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time they were sitting down to pray for me. This rocked me. So far as I know, they were the first people in my whole life who had ever prayed for me. And God knows I'd never prayed for anyone. Why did they care? Also, I remembered that they were not fools. They were not sitting down praying to nobody. They closed by saying that under separate cover, they were sending me a small magazine entitled Ben the Evangel, now called Faith at Work. And they wished that if I had time, I would look at it. I had time. I went through the second class mail and found this little magazine, opened it, and on the first page was a small article entitled, "It Is Never Too Late to Start Over," written by one Samuel M. Shoemaker, whom Bill Wilson says has had more to do with starting AA than any one single human being in the world. Of course, I didn't know that then, but then I didn't know of any other ministers either. I read the article and stood up, dropped the book, and did something I'd never done in my life. I went over to my bed and got down on my knees. And I said, "If you're anywhere around, I wish you'd please help me, because I sure need it." And in about 20 minutes, it was all over, and you can't get that down on paper either. All I know is that it was more like a spiritual shower bath than anything. I felt cleansed. I also felt welcomed. I had never had a home, and I had never made one, and I felt welcomed. I also felt forgiven. And I knew exactly who this was. I, who had never known anything about God in my whole life, knew exactly who this was. And pretty soon I stood up and I said, "Thank you very much, sir. I don't know anything about this, and I'm going to have to start from scratch. But I'll tell you one thing. I'll never take a drop of liquor again as long as I live, and I never have. And people say, I wish I had your character." Well, I don't have any character. It doesn't make sense that a woman of 53 should get down on her knees and 20 minutes later get up with character. That's just damn nonsense. Where had it been all this time? There was something added, you bet. A plus, and a plus is in the shape of a cross. Something had been added, and you and I call him God. And I started from scratch, all right. Within an hour, I had begun for the first time in my life, just a little, to think about the things that other women did, took for granted, that I had never done. I had never cooked anything in my whole life. Cooking is a very basic thing, of course. Most women expect to do it. I had never even lit a stove. So within the hour, I went to the telephone and called my bookman in Chicago, and I said, "Mr. Chandler, I want two books. I want the Holy Bible and the Joy of Cooking." He said, "My God, what's happened to you?" And I said, "My God has happened to me." I then called up a friend of mine, a former Roman Catholic. I thought she just might have met a minister. So I called her up and asked her if she knew any ministers. Well, I was just about this big. I know exactly what the New Testament means when it says, "Lest ye be born again." You bet I know. I was just this little teeny newborn thing. Now, when I asked her if she knew any ministers, and she said, "Do you want a go-getter, a man of God?" I almost died. A go-getter? A full-breast man with his collar turned the wrong way? I was absolutely horrified. Now, of course, I know what she meant. I've met so many. Not you, sweetie. And I said, horrified, "I want a man of God." Well, kids, I got one. No great shakes as a minister, as a preacher. His suit was almost green. It was so old. His shoelaces were knotted. When I later heard him preach, he would start out on a subject and get off and kind of wander around. But he had a light around him. He just happened to be Episcopalian. Just happened to be Episcopal. Denominations. I think they too are all buses going on the same road. They're labeled Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, Episcopal, what have you. And if God is a chauffeur, then the road rules are His Son's instructions, and the way leads to God, then they're all equally good. If they're not, they all stink. So this man just happened to be an Episcopal. Nothing makes me so mad as when somebody says, "And when were you converted to Episcopalianism?" How could you be converted to a church? How could you be converted to a man-made denomination? I was converted to God. I asked this man if I could please come to his church. He said it isn't much of a church and there aren't many people in it. I said, "But God be there, won't he?" And he said, "Yes, he'll be there." I said, "When's the first service I can come?" And he said, "Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. It's the Holy Eucharist." I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's the Holy Communion." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Why don't you just come and find out?" So I came and I found out, and I was the only person in the church except the minister. And it was the first time I ever heard the words, "We have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have offended against thy holy law. We have left undone those things which we ought to have done. And we have done those things which we ought not to have done, and there is no help in us. But thou, O Lord." Well, of course, I thought those words were written for me, and I still think so. I was simply staggered to think that people in churches weren't saints, that people in churches were ones who had erred and strayed from God's ways like lost sheep. I was sure in hell in the right joint. Well, of course, now that I began to know a little bit, a teeny little bit, about who it was in front of whom I had three times said, "Joseph, do us part," it became almost obsessive to me that I'd be allowed, perhaps, to make something at least dignified and friendly out of one marriage. And I almost prayed my knees off. Well, prayers are answered, all right, but very often the answer is no. Human relations are very delicate things, and sometimes the scars are too deep. And anyway, this thing had happened to me. It hadn't happened to Bill Behan. He thought I was crazy. He was just delighted, and everybody else was, that I wasn't messing up anybody's parties anymore. But they all thought I'd gone overboard for God. Well, you know, that's just nonsense. How could the created go overboard about the Creator? To seek Him, to know Him, to serve Him, is our destiny. It is our purpose, just as it is the peach tree's purpose to bear peaches. So when people now say, "Well, we kind of think you've gone overboard for God," I say, "Well, you know, I think you've gone overboard for breathing. Why don't you just breathe 20 hours a day and hold your breath for 4? Well, now, it may not change them, but it sure shuts them up. And with some people, that's a great miracle. No, the answer was no. Bill Behanna wanted a divorce, and because I had so greatly contributed to his desire for one, that I had to give it to him. And I went out to the desert in California to live, and it was on the desert that I found that money belonged to God and that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Connecticut for 10 months in 1952, and I thought a great deal about a woman who would come to me, and I'd failed with her, and I'd sent her to AA, and she'd gotten drunk. I felt badly about this and felt somehow involved. So when I returned in January of 1953, I went to a long-time beloved friend of mine, long-time member of AA, and I said, "Henry, how do you join AA?" And he said, "You walk in and sit down." So I walked in and I sat down, and of course, it was the first time I ever saw the big book, and I read Chapter 5 and how it works, and I read the 12 steps, and the tears poured down my face. You know why this works? It works because it's the truth. It works alone in your bedroom with God, or it works with people. The 12 steps are almost exactly what I had been doing for 5.5 years all alone with God. Very often in exactly the same order and very often in exactly the same language. I had found that I was powerless over alcohol, had admitted it, that my life had become unmanageable. I was making inventory after inventory all those 5 years. New ones, new ones, new ones. White sheet with a line down the center with credit and debit. I had been making amends wherever possible, except when to do so would harm people. Well, I couldn't believe my eyes. I had never had a brother or a sister. And here I had 250,000 of them, now closer to 500,000. I could not believe the fellowship, the friendship, the humor, the concern, the helping. Carl, I often think that I, with all those years of sobriety back of me, have a perspective on AA that those of you who got your sobriety through it cannot have. This is the greatest thing operating in the whole wide world today. This is what the early church was like. The concern for one another, and not this old drippy, drooly concern. I'm an old woman, and in the winter, in the middle of a sandstorm in the desert, I'm asleep at 3 o'clock in the morning under an electric blanket. My phone rings and somebody says, "Grit, I don't think I can make it till morning unless you come over." Well, I don't say, "Oh, well, you poor lamb, I'd just love to come." I say, "You're so-and-so, I'll be there. Where are you?" But I go. There isn't one of you who doesn't go. Well, you try calling up somebody churchy at 3 o'clock in the morning. You notice I didn't say a Christian. I said somebody churchy. We hear so often, so many people saying, that the big book is the Bible. Well, it ain't the Bible. It's a fine second, but it ain't the Bible. Now, those of you who have had denominations rammed down your gullet when you were young, I can understand perfectly why you want nothing to do with the Bible. But you don't want to miss the woods because you get bumped into by the trees. Denominationalism, you know, Christianity hasn't been tried and failed. It hasn't been tried. You don't need to be afraid of the New Testament. You'll find yourself on every page except the Begat. The tenth poll of the whole New Testament, a man by the name of Jesus Christ, went for bums. That was his sole reason for being here. Who is it that is the man in the gutter and also the man walking across the street to help the man in the gutter? Alcoholics Anonymous. Who is the prodigal son returning to his father, and who is the father who runs to meet him? Alcoholics Anonymous. The man 2,000 years ago said, give no thought for the morrow. We say it's the first drink you don't take. Make it a day at a time. Who was born to not see? Alcoholics Anonymous. Who was deaf and now hears? Weak. Who was lost and is now found? Who was dead and now lives? Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't be afraid of the New Testament, for crying out loud. It's your story and mine. My life is very crowded with people. People who come and stay, people who call up, people who wire, people who pay my expenses to come and see them. I'm trying to write another book. I don't get time. I'm asked to speak everywhere, and it should please you that it's mostly in churches. I really let them have it. Sometimes I get very tired, ask God to let me off the hook. He says, no, you were late, start and get going. We alcoholics want drama. I got it. We want something to sink our teeth into. I've got it. I would not have it less. I would just have it more so. Really, my whole life boils itself down to two questions that I ask myself every hour on the hour. And believe me, I do. The first question is, Gert, how are you doing with God? How are you doing with Him? What's the score? And the other question is, this for God or is this for Gert? If it's for God, we try to do it. If it's for Gert, we try not to do it. If we don't know, we wait. And now in closing, I want to repeat a prayer. And don't bow your heads. That's too easy. It's a prayer of a long-dead slave. Oh, Lord, I ain't what I want to be. Oh, Lord, I ain't what I ought to be. Oh, Lord, I ain't what I'm going to be. But thanks, Lord, I ain't what I used to be. Amen.